You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganiagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabe Mohen, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Day, live in studio on Thursday, February the 1st, 2024. It's a rainy, mild evening in Montreal. You might need an umbrella if you're headed to the Siegel Center to see the launch of Diggers. It's a Black Theater Workshop copro with CKUT. So cool. How did I not get the memo about that? A big mare to the crew and cast launching that show. You can check it out until, I believe, February 17th. And yes, that is a Donna Bernard production, a brand new show from her about gravediggers in a small community. Warren Asetsuelo is a part of the cast. Looks like it's going to be absolutely fabulous. You have a couple weeks to check that out, but don't wait. Siegel Center Studio, siegelcenter.org. I also want to say a big hello to the cast and team at Ricky, who launched officially at Wildside last night. Wow, a totally kooky show. It's only an hour, part of Wildside. I'm going to describe John Loughlin Stewart as the monster. It's a combination between Snuffleupagus, a tardigrade, and the beast from Where the Wild Things Are. I hope that's enough to make you want to go get your ticket. Very affordable at the Centaur through the weekend. Only a couple of shows left. We have a lot to talk about on this evening's show. We've got theater, we've got dance, we've got a drag cabaret to talk about. My guests tonight include two students from Dawson College's theater program. They have the very great privilege of doing the Canadian premiere of a very hot show, Tom Stoppard's hit play, Leopoldstadt. It follows a Jewish family living in the Vienna neighborhood of the same name over 50 tumultuous years in Europe. It's a saga that has garnered rave reviews, press attention, and several Tony Awards. And yes, it is getting its Canadian premiere at the new Dome. Our two students are already ready to go, joining us in just a moment. But still to come on the show after that, Wildside Fest Agitpop is a hilarious and heartbreaking cabaret for the end times. Xander Chung is here and will introduce you to its host, Pearl Harbor, the drag comedian persona of Justin Miller. Justin will be our guest later on. And Lara Kramer first performed at Espace Libre back in 2016. Nearly a decade later, this choreographer and dancer is preparing a retrospective for two of her works, covering resistance and reconciliation on her own terms. In Dreams, Technology, and Childhood, in Helen Samard's new dance work for young audiences, it's called Dans les bras de Morphée. I always look forward to chatting with Helen. Our conversation will be coming to your ears before the end of the hour. On to our first interview of the evening. Very happy to have in front of me two young students from Dawson College's theater program, Stephanie Hernandez and Philip Lamontis. I'm going to get your mics up, guys. Hold on. See, we're still coming out of pandemic where we're getting used to having people back in studio again, and I have to remember to put your mics up. Welcome to Upstage. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in on a rainy night as well. And it's a busy week because you're opening previews on Monday, I believe,
Yes. And
official show starting on Wednesday. Can you guys get a little bit closer to your microphones?
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
Be help if I put yours actually up, Philip. There we go.
I can adjust. It's okay.
No, it's me. I got to put your mic on to be able to hear you.
Oh, it's not on.
And now we're fixed. So this must be so exciting for you. I think it's a big deal to be doing a show once you're, you know, kind of getting out of putting on things in the classroom and actually having friends and family and strangers coming to see yourselves. But here you're doing the Canadian premiere of this major show. It was supposed to happen, I believe, in Toronto first,
yep.
A professional production, pandemic delays, et cetera, et cetera. Now it falls on your young shoulders.
Yeah.
How does that feel, Stephanie?
Oh, it's just... I mean, I feel very honored. I think we all do feel honored to be able to open this amazing play in Canada. But it's also, I feel terrifying. You know, it's a lot of pressure on us since it's the first time that it's performed here.
The good pressure, I would hope. Philip, how do you feel?
No, yeah, it's almost the same thing. It's like a big honor. It's a big thing, but it's also a big challenge, which I think is also very important, especially in like in the arts. I think the goal is to take risks and big challenges, and this is like a really big one to have on our shoulders. But I, looking at the cast and knowing these people, we're going to do great work, and I trust everybody and the director's genius. It's it's a big challenge, but I think we're going to overcome it for
and,
sure.
And not just because it's a big show, like we're covering a lot of ground, 50 years, but also because people might have preconceived ideas of what the show is going to be. Maybe they saw it in London, maybe they saw it in New York, or they've just heard about it. I mean, it won tons of Tonys, a handful, which is still like a lot. Yeah. so when you were first told about this by, I guess, the powers that be, your professors, the program, what questions did people have in the class?
Oh, so many. I think when we first read it, nobody understood. Like, we read it and we were like, I didn't understand anything of the play. There was a lot of research to make. Mm-hmm. As part of the research, we went to the Holocaust Museum as well. And it was just a lot of reading, lots of research for this play.
I guess because it's a historical epic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Philip, yeah, what were your first thoughts reading the script?
My first thoughts, and I think some of the first thoughts of other people, was really, how are we going to do this play justice? Because it's a really big play, and it has a lot of like really brilliant writing. Tom Stoppard, really smart, really like great playwright. And so it's really, how are we going to fill into the shoes of what the play already is, especially when we're getting a premiere and it's already a great play and it's a big play and it's all on us? It's really, how are we going to really like do this play the justice it deserves? And those were my first questions for sure.
So we meet a fan. In some ways, it's simple because we're following one family over the course of time. Tell me about the character. I'm curious to know how it's structured. Are you, as performers, playing a variety of characters through time, or are you kind of switching roles as each decade phases in? Is it told chronologically?
It depends of each person. I just have one character. For example, you two.
Same thing.
But there are some people who are playing different persons depending on how they got casted. There are some persons that are like going from child until they're like adults. Mm-hmm. So it's very challenging on that too. We're actually looking at makeup and costumes and how we're going to do quick changes and all of that. Yeah. It's just a lot to manage right now.
Well, that's a lot. That is indeed. Yeah. You're playing the role of Gretel.
Gretel, yeah.
Tell me about Gretel.
Oh, she's just magnificent. She's so fun to play. She's a lot of energy all the time, and I think I just said it's so fun to play, but I think her thing is just, she goes by pleasure and fun, and she just wants to see everything and be in everything and meeting lots of people all the time, and she's great.
Philip, your character?
Yes, I play Ludwig Jakubowicz, who is a mathematician who's stuck in his ways, you know. He's very, like, proud of being Jewish, and he's very... he doesn't really want to adapt with the times. He stays in his own ways. But one thing is for sure, he loves numbers. And I get to play him as he grows older. And so the one thing that stays true is the numbers, the mathematics, and how his obsession with that paves his way through life. And yeah, it's a really good story. And I love that every character has like their own little thing, but it shapes one big story as the family. And you see them progress and see them change. And it's so interesting.
But are you a math person yourself?
Me, no, which is really funny. I've never liked math in real life. I was never really good at it. But there's like a lot of like terms that he talks about in this play, like a lot of like theories and all that had to make me like really look them up, and they're very interesting. I don't have any problems with math. It just never was my thing, but this has forced me to like search it up, do more research.
Yeah.
And it's put me a little bit more interested into numbers.
There you go. You're taking something from that. That is Philip Lamontsis. And we're joined also by Stephanie Hernandez, who are two actors from the Dome Theater program at Dawson, who are putting on Leopoldstadt. Previews are going to be starting on Monday, and the show is running until February the 17th. We mentioned the history. So we cover World War One, the annexation of Austria by Germany, because this is set in Vienna, Austria, and then the aftermath of the Holocaust. You mentioned doing a lot of research, going to the Holocaust Museum, currently based in Côte des Neiges, going to moving soon to Saint Laurent, a couple of years actually. Did you each learn something about European history or World War One, World War Two that you had not known before, Philip?
Yeah. Well, for me, like, of course, like the Holocaust is something that they briefly teach in school, but I always had like this very kind of like one-sided way of seeing it. But when we went to the museum and also while reading this play, it covers so much more than I had ever thought. And like, there's so much information, like I still only know probably half of it, but like I learned a lot of like the true facts and what the people went through and like all like the tragedy and everything to like all the facts I've learned, and also how it affected other people and how it worked in other countries too. Because I always just think of, well, not always, but like in school it was taught Germany, but also this affected like in England and Canada and the US. It was like a worldwide thing, and it really teaches you more and more. So I did learn a lot, and I do feel like I still will learn a lot more just by playing the same role. Even though I'm saying the same lines, I'll still keep like learning because I still don't know everything. But yeah, I've learned a lot.
It's interesting that there are five acts, and there's 1899. That's where we open. Yep. 1900, 1924, 1938, and 1955. So come these pivotal years that either mark something changing or happening or processing afterwards. Stephanie, what was the process like for you? What did you learn that's something you may not have known about before?
So many things. Just as Philip said, like I just feel like I never stop learning. There's always something that I need to look up or like, do research on that. And it's just, I feel like the play, it talks a lot about the different opinions and points of view and ideologies that all these characters have, and that well, they existed in the time. And it's so interesting. It was so interesting to know more about and do research about all these different points of view. Yeah.
The playwright is Tom Stoppard. I think it's the kind of name where when people hear it, they go, even if you don't know a lot about theater, you go, oh yeah, that's someone who's really good. Yeah. having written the screenplay, I think for Shakespeare in Love, and then Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. But I'm curious to know what you guys thought of his script, and, you know, because the buzz precedes it. But what do you think works about the play itself? Like, what do you think stands out? What made it worthy of so much buzz since it started premiered in 2020?
I think for me, it's just the fact that there's time for everything in the play. It's just obviously there's tragedy, but there's drama, there's comedy, there's just everything. And it's just, it's timed perfectly in the play that it's just, it lets you feel and experience all these things. It's amazing. It's written amazingly, honestly.
Yeah. Well, another thing as well is like, since it's also based off a true story, like not fully, I believe, but it's like based off his like life. Mm-hmm. So every character feels really real. They have like real opinions and real like thoughts on the matter. What's interesting about it is that like, although yes, they're all going through the same thing, they kind of see it in different ways. And you see that kind of build together as the play progresses through the years as well. And since it's covering so many different years and like we're jumping decades sometimes, there's so much information that you have to like cover at the same time in between those acts that like, no, it's really interesting to see how these characters progress and how their opinions kind of like shape the play as you go on.
You're both graduating students from the 3-year acting program. So you have a couple months left to go. Yeah. How are you feeling right now?
Excited.
Like, not overwhelmed. I'm just whelmed by it all. Like, it's so like surreal that like, I still feel like I got in this program like yesterday.
Yeah.
And so now I'm like, in a couple months, I'm just out in the real world, you know?
Terrifying.
And it's terrifying, but it's also really exciting at the same time.
But when you think back to Philip and Stephanie starting out in just a couple of years ago, entering the program, did you guys start the program in the pandemic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You started fall 2020?
Yeah. So
2021.
Yeah. So our auditions were still like online.
Oh yeah.
And we still had to wear masks in class, but luckily for us, we had just past the wave where when we did our first play, we were able to do it without masks.
Yeah.
So
we're lucky.
We were lucky.
Back to little Philip and little Stephanie, how do you feel now?
Oh my God. I mean, I see the growth. I feel like I've learned a lot. Like sometimes you have to remember, sometimes I'm too harsh on myself and I'm like, I just need to remember that when I was in first year, I would have never imagined that I would be doing this. And it helps me. It helps myself.
I feel like a completely different person. Like, I feel the growth and I feel the maturity, and I feel like what this program as a whole, it's a big program and it's also like a family because you're with these people the whole time, has shaped me to the person I am now. And the way I see it, the person I am now is who the person year one wanted to be, and I'm very proud of that. And although, yeah, there's moments I was hard on myself, I do think this program and the people and just me overall shaped me to be where I am, and I'm very excited to see how I keep progressing. But definitely, I think Lil Philip would be proud. Definitely.
It's been really nice to meet both of you. Thank you both so much for coming in studio to chat with us about Leopoldstadt.
Thank you so much for
wishing you all the best for next week, Meld, and for graduation. I hope I get to see you guys soon in a professional capacity here on Upstage.
Knock on wood.
That is the voices of Philip Lemontis and Stephanie Hernandez, and they are graduating students from the Dawson Theater, the Dawson College Theater Program. If you would like to see them perform with the rest of the cast and team, you'll want to head to thepointofsale.com. Look up Leopoldstadt, that is spelled LEOPOLDSTADT, and look for Dawson and the Dome as your keywords. Previews are Monday, February the 5th and 6th, and then the show itself is 7th to the 17th. Are you guys switching casts, or are you on stage all the time?
It's going to be one cast the whole time.
You're guaranteed to see Stephanie and, and Philip when you see the show. Showtime is at 7:30, and there's a couple of matinees as well. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Still lots to come on this show, including choreographer Ellen Simard and choreographer Lara Kramer, who's getting ready for her retrospective at Espace Libre. But next, we will introduce you to Pearl Harbor of Agitpop Cabaret. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Webstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, listening to some Mathé there with their song Amayachi. Oh, love that tune. I'm handing it over to you now, Xander. You have a fascinating interview ahead about a Wildside production.
Definitely an exciting, exciting production. Today we're going to be talking to a wonderful burlesque and drag artist, Justin Miller, a.k.a. Pearl Harbor, about his upcoming show, Agitpop, at La Chapelle between February 6th to the 8th. Stories to be had, music to be explored, and the end times to be celebrated. Really happy to have you on here with us, Justin.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, 5 days and a bit left till curtain. How does it feel?
Well, I'm actually talking to you right now from my dressing room at the High Performance Rodeo, where we opened yesterday, and my face is currently baking in powder and industrial-grade concealers, so we're going to be well-oiled for our appearances in Montreal.
Well-oiled, that's a great way to put it. And you're under so... I'm always definitely intrigued with the, you know, the art of drag and burlesque with all of the costume and makeup and all that stuff. How does that, do you find that the makeup and the added extra costumes affect your performance? Does it help you get in the zone?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I find it changes the audience more than it changes me. When you put on all the drag, when you put on the sequins and the wig, there's a kind of instinctive response that people really rip open their rib cages for you and invite you to jump inside their guts and swim around. They let you get closer than you ever could by making yourself this strange, fantastic, fabulous vision of yourself or this other creature entirely. And that's what I really love about it. It's actually quite tiresome to be pulling out a medical-grade adhesive from my eyebrows at, like, 1 a.m. in the morning, but it's worth it for what it does to audiences.
So the surrealism of it all really seems to invite a kind of intimacy. Is that something that you've sort of discovered throughout your process, or was this kind of your intention with the work that you specifically do? You know, in your press, we're talking about, you know, nuclear anxiety, climate disasters, you know, and my personal favorite, the lust for housing.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't want a tidy little bungalow with a fenced-in yard? Just some place that you can't get rent evicted out of? Wouldn't that be dreamy? For me, I come from the world of clown, and specifically a type of clown called Buffon, which is this sort of nasty mocking figure that points out our hypocrisies, the piousness and the view that we hold ourselves, these good creatures that we pretend we are, but we're always hiding, you know, these horrible judgments, these hatreds, this greed, you know. We all share in that. We like to pretend that's not our lot, but we all share in that. So from the get-go, this is kind of what I was doing with drag as the kind of cover. So always getting into the issues that matter to me, the anxieties and terrors that I experience, the worst parts of myself, but encapsulated in this tasty package of pearl that makes it all a little bit more palatable and a lot more fun to explore.
Your alliteration game is on point, by the way.
Thank you.
I love it. And yeah, no, that actually really speaks to me. You're hitting a lot of my buttons here. I am obsessed with the idea, this literary, tradition of the fool being the one truth teller. You know, you can look at shows dating back to the Shakespearean period with King Lear, mm-hmm. the rest,
yeah.
You know, it is always the person who is just, it is always the liminal figure, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely, you know, like, and that's why I think people react the way they do when you're in drag. That's why they open up the way they do. It's instinctive. It's ancient. We've always looked to figures that were larger than life that came from the outside to tell us truths about ourselves that we're too frightened to speak. The things we've dismissed, buried and forgotten ever since, you know, we were taking in stories and watching dances by the fire. It's part of this ancient practice, and you feel that. People know that on a cellular level, so it's really cool to play around with it.
Yeah, and, like, speaking of, you know, larger-than-life figures, especially, you know, when it comes to bombast and, you know, costumes, performance, your show plays with the likes of Bowie and Britney Spears and the Beach Boys, that to name a few. What drew you to these artists, and how does your show interact with these, personalities?
Yeah. So the music is kind of the spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine go down. So agitpop, the title, for one, was a mistake because nobody understands it. It's a very academic joke that I was really contented with, but boy, is it a hindrance now. It's a riff on agitprop, agitation propaganda, which, you know, is a political tool that's wielded to try to sell you an idea of how the world is supposed to work. So agitpop is agitation pop music. So each act that we do dives deep into an issue or an anxiety or something urgently wrong, like right now, ripped from the headlines in our world. But we explore it through these bendy ways, and each story, each monologue, each observation is paired with a completely original arrangement by our phenomenal musical director, Stella Conway, of these classic pop hits, some of the biggest songs of the last 50 years. Because that's kind of a way in for us. We know these songs. We know how they're supposed to sound. We take them and twist them, and we try to use them to show you a different perspective or a different angle on this, you know, terrible time that we're living in. And ultimately, you know, explore these issues, but not in a way that's overwhelming or paralyzing, but that's empowering and hopeful. You know, change is still possible.
Change is definitely still possible. And honestly, if not for the people who make us laugh, who else are there to tell us these, you know, truths and these possibilities? I'm always kind of enthralled by how, you know, authors, performers, artists use humor to demystify what normally would be considered, you know, a taboo. You know, you're not going to talk about nuclear annihilation over the dinner table, at least most of us don't.
Some come of us over do. To dinner with me and we'll see about that.
You know, I might actually take you up on that offer. But I'd love to hear about your process on how you balance that tightrope that is humor and truth.
Yeah, well, I don't see them as opposites in any way. I think it's just one of the ways that we can walk toward the truth, and it's a more enjoyable one. It's a it's one that fills us with pleasure and makes us feel good. And I think it's important to indulge in that. Entertainment is super valuable. It's not all you'll get at a Pearl Harbor show. You know, there are definitely provocations and moments of grotesque, you know, fear and rage and all of these wonderful, beautiful, sustaining emotions. But it does keep us a little safe, or it allows us to kind of expunge these things in a way that is more productive. You know, we can't just go out there and either be completely miserable in our own dour little world. Otherwise, you become like a Jordan Peterson fan.
Oh, God.
So I think it's really key to remember that you're generally never alone in these terrible feelings. And if you dare to, like, speak a little bit about them, you'll find a lot of comfort and a lot of company. And that's the same with the fact that we call this the agitpop is a doomsday cabaret. Things feel really bad right now. Things feel really violent and dangerous and like we're on the edge of something. But humans have been decrying that the end times are around the corner forever. We've always been saying that. So this is an impulse that we have as a species that can be managed and can be overcome. And as long as we're working together to a better tomorrow, you know, we can really do a lot. So band together, laugh, be like, yeah, it's rotten, but we're going to change it.
Honestly, I'm right there with you. You're listening to the voice of Justin Miller, a.k.a. Pearl Harbor, talking about his upcoming show, Agitpop, which can be seen at La Chapelle between February 6th and the 8th. Justin, I have to say, if there are any mushroom clouds over the horizon, there isn't a place I'd rather be than to be in your audience. Well, I really can't wait. How about you, Sarah? Yeah. How about you, Sarah? I got my tickets. Are you going to join me to ring in the apocalypse?
I'm sold just listening to Justin talk about Pearl and where they're coming from as an artist. Justin, I'm very excited.
Amazing. And well, can't wait to see you there.
And I hope it's okay, but I've picked up some David Bowie because that's one of the artists that you're going to be channeling, right?
Oh, any Bowie is good Bowie. So perfect. Please go ahead.
How about Let's Dance Bowie then?
I'm phenomenal. Already out of my seat.
Oh, you got it. There we go.
There we go.
Thank you so much, Sander, and thank you so much, Justin Miller, performing as Pearl Harbor at Call Center LN next week, February 6th to the 8th. You've been listening to, you are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Sarah DeA. You just heard Sander speaking with Pearl Harbor there just a moment ago. For tickets and more information, head to lachapelle.org. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to chat with choreographer Lara Kramer, who is going to be having a retrospective of her work at Espace Libre, just under a decade since she first performed there. We'll find out about why her pieces, Wendigo and Thin Voices, will be part of this retrospective. And still to come, Helen Simard's new work for dance being presented to a young audience. She'll tell us about her fascination with the myth of Morpheus. Welcome back to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're playing some David Bowie there. Passed away and has his birthday both in January, so you hear a lot of David Bowie right at the start of the year. But so fitting because David Bowie is going to be a part of the Pearl Harbor show Agitpop. And of course, Let's Dance brings us to the next two interviews of the evening. Choreographer Helen Simard will join us later on. But first, we're going to have the very talented, well-respected choreographer Lara Kramer on. First performed a piece at Espace Libre. It's a former fire station turned dance and performance arts space near Frontenac Metro Station, so just east of the village. So she first performed there in 2016, and just under a decade later is getting ready now to have a retrospective of two of her works there starting later this month, February 8th to the 10th. You can catch the performance, the piece Windigo, and Them Voices as part of the show. Lara's very involved with the remounting of the two pieces at Espace Libre. She is an artist who follows her gut first and foremost, but is also very interested in telling her personal family history as someone who grew up with both settler heritage and OG Cree heritage, and is also fascinated by the topics of reconciliation and resistance and resilience, but on her own terms. Lara joins us here on Upstage. Good evening, Lara. Thank you for being here.
Annie, bonjour. Thanks you for having me.
How does it feel as an artist who's been active for several years to be bestowed, I guess, with a retrospective? Does that word have any meaning for you?
I mean, it does. I think how it came about is really from a rapport and a relationship with the former artistic director of Espace Libre, Geoffrey Gayet. He, this is part of his, like, he is no longer there, but I was launched in his first season of programmation, and sort of to bring full circle, he wanted me to be a part of his final season of programmation that I believe was done in partnership with, like, the current AD. But, in some ways, I had maybe it's kind of funny, I have a friend of mine, colleague, sort of pointed out and said, you seem a little young. So maybe it's like aging me, or I don't know exactly, you know, it's for sure up for interpretation a bit.
Well, I was looking at your website, larakramer.ca, if you want to visit there. A lot of really interesting work there, not just about your dance, but your other artistry and your teaching as well. And you have archives for your calendar, and the first archive goes back to 2011, 2012. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think dancers, your careers start at a very young age as artists. But yeah, like, you've been active for nigh on over a decade now, of course. And mm-hmm. so it's not unusual to say, like, aren't you kind of young for that? but I feel like your body of work does bear having kind of this looking back and evaluating it. Is it gênant as an artist to kind of get to do that kind of work? Is it difficult for you or easy?
I mean, I think in this case, in particular, I mean, the capacity to show some work, we were really in discussion about two pieces, and I think in one way, one was already predetermined because when Then Voices premiered at the Festival Transmérique, I was immediately approached and asked if there was opportunity already to show the work Them Voices. So it was sort of a given that that piece was going to be remounted for this particular event. I think where the discussion landed was really what would accompany it. You know, I do have much older works, but I think in selecting Windigo, for me, there was a little bit more of a through line of connection between the two works, which would open up, and I think, a little more dialogue and conversation.
Windigo is a fascinating title because it borrows from mythology or folk tales, right? But this is also a piece that's about your grandmother. Can you tell me about the story you're telling in Windigo?
Yes. So, no, this story doesn't really dive into my grandmother at all. I think maybe the note you saw was regarding Native Girl Syndrome, which is the first work I showed at Espace Libre, you referenced in 2016. Mm-hmm. Windigo, I mean, we have our Anishinaabe story around Windigo, but when I was diving into this piece, I was more taking the angle or stance at looking at these contemporary notions of Windigo, which is still around consumption and greed, but the more capitalistic view of extracting resources from the land and the consumption and that comes from colonialism, essentially.
Because I understand Windigo is rooted in a folktale. It's not a monster story necessarily, but you're drawing from these older stories, but giving this very fresh look to them.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's like I'm definitely informed by my, by cultural knowledge. But I think when I'm approaching my work and the way I've always gone through my creative process with my material or narrative is I'm always in this space of still looking at how am I remaining sort of present in these contemporary realities. And I think it's not very hard to see, I mean, even presently, but, you know, when I was creating this work, I believe I started the incubation period around 2016, 2017. And I was actually pregnant for a good portion of that period. And I think what, you know, where I did draw parallels through family stories was also like revisiting family territory up north in Laxo First Nations, and just also getting an overview of devastation of land that has occurred over the years from, you know, very similar aspects of what I mentioned about land extraction and greed and the consumption of resources, and seeing the longevity of effects through the generations that has, you know. So as I was approaching the work and the creative process, like a lot of these recounts of these stories and these notions that I'm seeing, and not just isolated to the north at all, like we see them in our day-to-day about just our relations to land and the way we maneuver and regard it and dispose of it so easily, you know. Just it's not just strictly to the land, but our relationality with resources and nature as well. So yeah, the Windigo really is, yes, it's this, you know, there's the old stories of the cannibalistic being, and I think in some ways there is imagery of that within the work, but it's quite multifaceted. I think in my process I really try to leave a lot open for like a multi-layered possibility. So it's quite sculptural, like I am working with performers, but there's quite a lot of anchor within materiality. So we see the way materials are being transformed and discovered, and then through that there's a lot of, I want to say, storytelling that occurs and symbolism and, yeah, parallels that you can draw.
I'm speaking with artist Lara Kramer, who's getting ready to perform Windigo, the piece we're discussing now, as well as Them Voices, as part of a retrospective co-presented with Espace Libre next week. So you will be performing Windigo on Thursday, February 8th at 8 p.m. and then on Saturday at 8 p.m. as well. The other piece being Them Voices. You talked a little bit about why those two pieces in particular. It has to do with your history with this space and the people there. What kind of links can you draw between Windigo and Them Voices? They're touching on different material, but I feel like there's a through line.
Yes, for sure there's a through line. I mean, I think for me it's also like as an artist, when you are creating work, there's often, I'll say, some ways I guess I can describe it as almost like chapters to your own practice and process. And so Them Voices really was, it wasn't the piece that I created necessarily that followed Windigo, but it was the piece that actually had the life, you know, that there was a previous work that's sort of in the middle of those two. But really, in some ways, I just felt like that there's a lot I'm contending with inside Them Voices. So just maybe for listeners to understand, that Them Voices is a solo work that I'm performing in. Windigo, I am on stage. I am... it's two male performers, Jasmin Hindi and Peter James, and then I'm also in the space with them conducting the sound. So it's all original sound scores, field recordings, and sounds I've edited and mixed together for that piece. And then when I'm traveling through Them Voices, this piece, in a lot of ways, I want to say, it feels like I'm dealing with almost the residue of Windigo and challenging myself to think beyond the horizon with what I'm contending with. So there's a feeling of futurism inside of it. I'm really inside this action of listening to a multitude of voices and stories that exist within my world and but beyond that as well. So this idea of crafting my own future memories. And I think for me, there's this, yeah, this journey, not just as a human, but an artist to always feel this continuity of like, where am I going? And also looking forward to future generations.
It must feel pretty special to have that space. You're doing two different pieces, but you have this flow between them that you're recovering when you move on to the next one of sorts. It must feel like a very special, special experience.
Yeah, well, yes, for sure, for sure. It's definitely a privilege and a wonderful opportunity. And yeah, both these pieces actually have been at that space, at Espace Libre. So it's going to be really fun to be back in there and just allowing them to exist together.
My last question for you, Lara, very quickly, is you are looking back at pieces that you've performed before, as you said, in the same space as well. Do you find you have seeds being planted right now in kind of going back to roots, but seeds being planted for what you're going to do next?
Oh, yes, yes, for sure. I have started a bit in the creative process with a work that will be revealing itself in the not-so-far future. I'm focusing on a little bit more of like the sharing and collaborating of my work and materiality. Like I spent Them Voices was also developed in the pandemic and in a very much a way, I want to say I had quite a wealth of opportunity to like really sit with it, you know, just in that dialogue with myself, with my own work. Maybe not to give too much away, but I am creating work in a way of have been able to share a little bit more of the transference of my material to other artists.
Well, we'll have to look for that then. Lara, thank you so much for coming on Upstage. I hope we'll have the pleasure of having you back again.
Yeah, Chi McGuidge, thank you for having me.
That is the eminently talented Lara Kramer, who will be performing in Windigo and Them Voices. As she clarified there, I swapped the two pieces. She will be on stage for Windigo and then performing that piece and on stage as well for Them Voices, which will be performed by two other dancers as well. Very exciting things happening at Espace Libre, February 8th to the 10th. Both shows are separately done, so you're not going to see them together. I think they need the space for them, really, to fully appreciate them. For tickets and more information, please head to espacelibre.qc.ca or call 514-521-4191 for the box office. And to keep an eye on Lara's work, some of the work that she was teasing just there, head to larakramer.ca. That's LarakraMer.ca. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our final interview of the evening is with Helen Samard. She's known for her rock and roll kind of edge. She had a whole triptych, as I'm about to mention, that was inspired by Iggy Pop. But she has a new work she'll be presenting next week to school kids at Agora de la Danse. There is a public performance on Saturday the 10th at 4 p.m. It's about dreams and where we go when we fall asleep. Here is my conversation from earlier this week with Helen Samard of We All Fall Down Productions. Welcome back to Upstage, Helen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
You have a reputation for doing rock and roll kind of shows. There was that triptych inspired by Iggy Pop. Your work is a lot of fun. And here you are with a show called Dans les bras de Morphée, which, you know, modern depictions of Morpheus sometimes show him as a rock star because he is a popular musician in as far as the legend goes. So are you continuing this Helen theme of rock and roll edge?
I love that question. I mean, it wasn't the intention, but I think what's been really fascinating with this project is getting to think so much about my own childhood and adolescence and really reconnect to, you know, ideas of how important music videos and like popular culture were to me as a child, and trying to connect that in a work that, you know, speaks to my nostalgia about childhood, but that hopefully can also speak to the references of children today so that we can make connections across generations between our shared experiences of innocence and playfulness and dreaming.
So in the show, Ellen, you're referring to video games and comic books, these hallmarks of media from children's childhoods when you're a little bit older as a kid. What are some of those references that you landed on when you were developing the piece?
Yeah, I think that the way that we got into this idea of looking for references and finding references through media was kind of from me looking at my own childhood as I dove into this project and thinking about making a project for children. And what really struck me was kind of about how I'm of an age group where we didn't have access to on-demand media. We didn't have access to all the references in the world. You really only had access to what was on TV when you happened to be watching TV, the radio, the songs that were on the radio at the time you were listening to the radio, the books that you could get access to at the library. You couldn't just Google search for anything and get access to anything. So there was kind of this fun play in the game of looking at my own references from childhood. Some of them, yes, from literature, from films, from television, from music, from video games from my era, which are very different from the video games of today, and kind of looking at how that kind of web of references creates a kind of collective unconsciousness that people of a certain generation share. And then as we move backwards or forwards in time, you can start to realize that references are made of references throughout time. So, you know, people from my generation were sometimes making references based on references from a generation before, from the early 20th century. Kids now today sometimes are making references based on things from my childhood that they might not realize. So we were like, how is it fun to, you know, allow me to dive back into looking at, you know, music videos that I loved, or looking at movies that I loved, or looking at video games that I played, you know, on a Nintendo or an Atari, and look at how children have a relationship with similar media today that builds on their understanding of how to create a collective imagination. So I think there's this really interesting place between references from a society in a time and place that are shared by children, and how that influences how they see the world growing up, and then the types of ways that they might let their subconscious space emerge through the art they make, or then let the art they make influence new subconscious spaces.
It feels like you're being an archaeologist of pop culture, almost like carving through the layers to figure out what means what to who.
It really has felt like that, because sometimes when we've had encounters with children throughout this process, you know, they'll say things like, oh my gosh, it's like that scene from Stranger Things, or oh my gosh, it's like that Spider-Man meme. And that might not be what I was making reference to initially, but that reference then makes reference to something that they understand through their popular media consumption. And so we share this like moment of a moment of like finding a little nugget of shared information, or an Easter egg, we could say, that's just hiding there that we both share, but across like different decades.
It's funny because you'd think that a lot of references kind of go out of fashion completely, or that the kids today are processing things that are totally detached from what we grew up with. But you just mentioned Spider-Man, and Spider-Man's been around for decades. And even something like the popularity of Stranger Things, the Netflix TV show about four kids on an adventure fighting aliens. Well, that show is referencing action movies and language from the 80s and bringing back music like Kate Bush is Running Up That Hill. So it all kind of is a bit cyclical. Was that intended for you to have that future retro nostalgia being worked in there?
I don't think we really realized that that's what we were working on until we started being in the work. And that's kind of eventually what brought us to looking and digging through a bit of Greek mythology to get to this idea of Morpheus and of the personification of dreams. I mean, this is a legend that is hundreds, you know, of years old, and that continues to influence the way we understand dream spaces and sleep today. So we might forget that we know the reference across generations, but we don't forget the reference because it stays there built into the way that we move forward together. So, you know, a child might not know a particular, you know, Renaissance era painting that we looked at in our process, but they might have seen artwork that was influenced by that at a later date, or a cartoon that makes reference to it. And it's really fascinating once you start looking at references through popular media, how you realize how much we just reference and re-reference ourselves and tell the same stories over and over again. And I think that's as old as time.
That is the voice of choreographer Helen Simard getting ready to present Dans les bras de Morphée with her company We All Fall Down. What is it about the story of Morpheus, this person who travels to the afterlife, that it captivates you as an artist and as a person?
I think what I really appreciated when I started looking at the stories around Morpheus, who is, you know, again, the personification of sleep, he's the personification of dreams, the son of sleep, grandson of the night, and the night is the daughter of chaos. So I think that there's something as a theme of chaos, that organized chaos, that comes back over and over in my work. It's kind of an obsession, one could say. And when we kind of got into this looking at what a personification of sleep is, or what is a sleep guide, who is a person who helps you navigate your dreams and navigate that subconscious space, it really made me think about like how important nighttime and sleeping and dreaming is to children. And kind of sometimes as we get older, when we get more fixed in our attachment to waking life and everyday life and things being real and happening the way they should, we forget about how important that subconscious space is. As human beings, we spend about a third of our lives, if we're healthy, sleeping. And so that place is actually a really important part of us. So I thought it was interesting to be like, how can we look at these myths that touch on this notion of the importance of having a guide who brings you through your dreams, who can help you influence your waking life? And can we as adults look at the child inside of us to help us remember that space where we get to let go of concrete reality and let go of things having to be logical and just follow poetry and follow impulse and follow, the more fuzzy sides of humanity. I thought it was a really fun place to make a show that is for kids, but at the same time can maybe speak to an adult who needs a bit of that dreamscape right now in their lives.
Oh, who doesn't? You have 7 performers on stage. They're wearing masks. This show is being described as whimsical and kind of enchanting and surprising. Tell me about the visual look of Dans les bras de Morphée.
Mm-hmm. I'm really fortunate to be working with Tiffany Bofa and Trisha Civilero and Jade Simard, who are doing the lighting and as well as the costume design. We spend a lot of time looking at the world of references that we're looking at, not just choreographically or conceptually, but also visually. And we really are continuing on this journey that we have been with our company for a while of finding a real root in German Expressionism, but then also getting into looking at the Muppet Show, looking at game shows from the 1980s, looking at the entire catalog of music videos by The Cure, and kind of looking at these like reference spaces of stark contrasts, bright colors, really graphic, really like cartoony type of looks that outline the body. The work with masks is really fascinating because it lets us have every performer become several different characters, go through several different physicalities, and even distort the understanding of the body so that we can create like new types of humans on stage by shifting where the focus or where the face on the body is. It's been a lot of fun to dive into mask work and to object manipulation with this show. It's been a lot of fun to allow ourselves to be a bit more playful and silly maybe than we have with our recent shows.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. That sounds absolutely fantastic. Your husband is a frequent collaborator. That is my conversation with choreographer Helen Simard. You can check out her latest work. It is called Dans les bras de Morphée. It'll be presented to school kids next week during the school day, obviously. Yes. But what will be fun is that the public is invited to check out the show February 10th at 4 p.m. For tickets and more information, head to agoradance.com. You can also check out a trailer there. If you head to Vimeo and look up Helen's work, she'll be there. Her company is called We All Fall Down, and they do terrific, terrific work. You've been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. A very big thank you to our guests. We met 2 Dawson students, Stephanie Hernandez and Philip Lemontis, as well as Helen Simard, choreographer Lara Kramer, and Xander had a great chat with Justin Miller, aka Pearl
Harbor. For more information about our guests, visit us at Upstage CKUT on Instagram, where we link to companies and to performers there. And you can also grab a photo on our Instagram stories of Stephanie and Philip in studio here live. Still getting used to doing that. Very fun to have people in studio post-pandemic. We will be back next Thursday with more stories about theater in Montreal. Thank you so much for taking time to join us tonight. If you're looking for things to see this weekend, Wildside Fest continues with Ricky, and a big merit to the team at Diggers. They are performing. They're opening up in about 45 minutes from now at the Siegel Center Studio. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Up next is Grey Matters with my friend Fortner Anderson.
Tu t'es occupé de ton ami qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière-en-santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts, Omar Aziz is a writer, journalist, lawyer, and former foreign policy advisor in the administration of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He has clerked for the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and many other publications. He is the author of Brown Boy. So, here's tonight's lecture, Fascism in America. The speaker, Omar Aziz.
Nazism draws from a deeper wellspring of Western ideas. The Nazis didn't just look at the Jim Crow law and segregation, they also studied American race law, American law to do with indigenous people, American colonial law, and laws around marriage and property as well. The actual policymakers of the Nazi regime learned a lot from the United States because America was the world leader of race law at that time. And at times, the Nazis actually thought American law around the one-drop rule and other forms of segregation was actually too harsh. And in the end, Nazi lawyers and jurists rejected American race law for being too extreme.
That's Omar Aziz. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Omar Aziz on fascism in America.